Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can creatures who died more than 60 million years ago tell us about life in the 21st century? And can they help us predict the future of the planet? My guest today has led paleontology expeditions all over the world, finding evidence of prehistoric life in the U.S., Asia, Australia, and South America. But his work in the world's coldest places might take you by surprise. Paleontologist Tony Fiorillo has coordinated a team of scientists investigating dinosaur remains as far north as Alaska's North Slope. Among other things, they want to understand how large, cold-blooded animals could possibly have survived and thrived in the frozen north. Tony Fiorillo is curator of earth sciences at the Dallas Museum of Nature and Science, and he's an adjunct professor at SMU. He and his work are featured in the NOVA episode that will air next Tuesday, October 7th on KERA Channel 13 television. It's called Arctic Dinosaur. Tony, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So regardless of how people might feel about Arctic oil exploration, I guess in this case, it led to some extraordinary finds.
Yes. In fact, the first dinosaurs from the North Slope were found by an oil geologist from Shell. And it was a survey as part of what might be out there in terms of oil and gas. And he found these bones, which they're so beautifully preserved. He wasn't a paleontologist, so he had put a little note on there that they were mammoth bones. They were filed away in the warehouse, and they were left unstudied until about the mid-1980s when a vertebrate paleontologist by the name of Charles Repenning with the U.S. Geological Survey saw these things and said, oh, no, they're not mammoth bones. These are dinosaur bones. And that pretty much is when the start of the great rush north for learning more about these things started.
And I know that ordinarily when a paleontologist is working, it's all, you know, tiny little brushes and you have to be really careful. And in this case, you're working in many cases in the permafrost, mm-hmm. and you guys come in with dynamite.
Well,
or explosives.
Our group actually didn't get involved with explosives so much. What we did was we did things more the old-fashioned way because the nature of where we were working, dynamite didn't give us the advantage. But we did use dental picks and brushes and so on, and you do hit pockets of permafrost, frozen ground. And so our technique was quite simply to work around the borders of that and wait for the sun to melt it and then push that back 6 inches and then do the process all over again.
What are the work conditions like when you're in a place like Alaska at the North Slope? It's freezing cold part of the time, and even in the summer season, it's not particularly pleasant, is it?
Well, the conditions are highly variable, as you might imagine. In some, probably the norm for up there is to always be bundled up and expect the worst weather. And it's usually pretty cool. And by that, I mean it's probably somewhere in the mid-40s. So you get a sense as to what you're wearing. The seasons happen very quickly. Quite often we'll start our camp and the flowers up there are just coming out. And then 3 or 4 weeks later, fall has come. The flowers are gone. They've gone to seed. The leaves are turning and so on. So depending on when you're there, sometimes the bugs are absolutely awful. They're beyond description. You swat a mosquito and you're swatting hundreds of them. I've followed people across the tundra and their backs are so covered with mosquitoes, I can't tell the color of their shirt anymore. Then there are other times that the weather's so remarkable. It could be 80 degrees. And one time we were working in a quarry that's featured in the film where it occurred to me that I was wearing the exact same blue jeans and T-shirt that I'd worn on a dinosaur excavation in Big Bend. Of course, I'd washed them since I'd been in Big Bend, but I just thought how ludicrous this situation was. You just get prepared for everything.
So it can be very warm. There are also temperatures in the other extreme during the other seasons. How does that compare with the kind of weather that there might have been at the time that dinosaurs were living in?
Well, obviously, the weather up there today, it's notorious for being brisk, and it's frozen. The river that we work on is called the Colville River, and it gets frozen pretty solid. I mean, you can drive trucks on it. And compared that to the time frame that we're working is about 70 million years ago, give or take a few weeks. And based on the various lines of evidence, we consider the climate back then to be significantly warmer. But what does significantly warmer mean? It's probably not like what we experience here in Dallas. It's more like the Pacific Northwest, a much more even-keeled, moderate temperature. The general, what we use is the mean annual temperature range. And the mean annual temperature range that's used most often in reconstruction for the North Slope is something between modern-day Portland, Oregon, and Calgary, Alberta. And if you've been to either one of those places, you know that they can still get pretty cold and they can still get pretty hot, but the mean annual temperature is about that.
One might imagine that a cold-blooded animal would have a really hard time in a climate that got even that cold.
You would think so. That's certainly the way people would perhaps view that. But one thing to keep in mind is our perceptions of physiology are it's probably one of the most misunderstood areas in trying to reconstruct what past animals did. Because in the modern-day Arctic, as extreme as it is now, there are warm-blooded and cold-blooded animals out there. And I remember one of my first trips to Alaska, we were cutting, we were outside of Fairbanks, and we were cutting boat sticks. And it became ever so clear to me why we needed boat sticks once I was on the river, but I hadn't been on the river yet. And while we were walking in the woods, my colleague and I, looking for the appropriate boat stick, I put my foot down and a frog jumped. And I wasn't thinking too much about that. I was thinking about boat sticks. And I took about two more steps, and then I stopped. And I thought, I just saw a frog in interior Alaska. And the temperature in interior Alaska can get to minus 70 degrees with some regularity in the winter. What is a frog doing here? And that's when I learned that the wood frogs of interior Alaska are the same frogs that occur all the way down to Alabama and North Carolina. So there's a cold-blooded animal that's doing quite nicely in this environment. So the cold-bloodedness is probably not as big of an issue as the general public might expect.
You're going to have to forgive me. What's a boat stick?
Okay. The boat stick is the way we access these cliffs quite often is through boats. And if you watch the film, you'll see we're working right along the banks of a major river. And I don't know how much boat experience you have. It's not the same as driving a boat on one of the reservoirs around here. You drive a boat up a river, there's a lot of gravel bars that are present there. And you have to read the water, otherwise you ground your boat on a bar or grind your propeller, which is really kind of a drag because the propeller is what makes the boat go, and so you really don't want to bang up your propeller. If you get stuck on a bar, one of the ways you get off it is you take your boat stick out of the boat and you lean into it, and the best way to describe it is think back on any picture you might have seen of Lewis and Clark going up the Missouri River. That's what it's like. You're pushing your boat along through shallow water using your boat stick.
So you need something that's somewhat disposable in case it snaps while you're trying to get away?
Yeah, we've never had one snap because the tree that we look for is really pretty robust and can handle the pressure. I mean, that's one of the reasons why you're looking for the good boat stick is you're looking for a particular kind of tree, and that tree, if you're wondering, is a larch. But yes, once in a while, you know, then you've also got your paddles, and if something snaps, then you pull your boat ashore and look for a substitute because you really need these to get up and down the river.
It's really interesting the kinds of skills that you have to have as a scientist that would seem to have nothing to do with what it is you're trying to do, but I guess it all contributes to you having a better understanding of the environment in which you're working.
In fact, there's a couple of issues you just touched on. You're right. As a graduate student, I don't recall the class, or maybe I was sick that week, that covered small boat repair and piloting a boat. But you'll learn as you go. And I think that one of the things, if you surveyed the people who work in the Arctic now, regardless of what they're studying, almost every one of them will lament a day that's now gone by where we had a certain freedom to be out longer than a tight window where you have to get in, get your data, and get out. Because then the people from yesteryear who were able to spend weeks upon weeks or months upon months out there saw a certain biological rhythm to the land, which then also helped them understand the database that they were building for their own specialty. And so based on the pressures that we all face now, that's a day gone by that most of us wish we could have touched once or twice.
Why are schedules so contracted now? Is it a budget thing?
It's, you know, if you've heard the reports that everybody's working harder and it seems like falling farther and farther behind. It's not specific to us. It's just the way culture is.
Paleontologist Tony Fiorillo is my guest. He's curator of Earth Sciences at the Dallas Museum of Nature and Science. He's featured in the Nova film Arctic Dinosaur that premieres next Tuesday, October 7th on KERA Channel 13 TV. We'll be back to our discussion with Tony in just a moment. You'll have a chance to talk to him by calling 1-800-933-5372. We will ask right now, though, that you call a different phone number, 1-800-456-5372. Become the next new or renewing member of KERA. You can do this with a credit card. You can do it with a personal check. You can set up a sustaining membership. We have been raising money for 12 days now. We are down to just over 1/10 of the total amount that we need before we will be able to stop the fundraising for months on end. $53,600 remains to get us to our goal. 1-800-456-5372 is our telephone number. We would love to be able to send you, this is an apt thank you gift. We have family 4-packs of tickets to the Museum of Nature and Science. When you make a $60 credit or debit card contribution or above, you will be able to receive these. So we've got a limited number. We've got only 10 of them. So if it's something that you'd like to have, I'm not sure what the regular admission is, but it seems like it's pretty close. And with just a $60 contribution, you might even make that as an additional gift. You'll be able to take the family down. And in fact, you can go down into the basement, and we'll talk to Tony about this a little bit, and you can see them working in their paleontology lab, which is a big thrill around our family. So if you would like to have that and you would like to support KERA, call 1-800-456-5372. Jeff Whittington is here now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. KERA.org is the web address. Of course, if you want to take advantage of this offer from our friends over at the Museum of Nature and Science, the family 4-packs, you've got to make a $60 contribution on a credit or debit card. You got to call because there's only 10 of those family 4-packs available during this hour. So it will be the next one, 1-800-456-5372. Go online to KERA.org if that suits you. And we want to say thanks to some people, Jackie and Natalie Cole in Wichita Falls, Kate Umble in Denton, and Volga Powell Warrior in Euless. Thanks so much for your contribution at 1-800-456-5372.
Takes a very short time to make your contribution. They're coming in fast and furious now. Everyone's coming together who believes in public radio and has waited for the last day. We know there are a large crop of you out there that really like to be here on the very last day. We are hoping against hope that this will be the last day, and all we have to do is reach our financial goal and we'll be finished with fundraising. That's the great thing about it around here is that we don't have any pressure on us to go above and beyond and sort of make a profit for the station. We just have to fulfill our budget requirements, and then as soon as we have what we need to give you the programming that you count on, then we're done.
It's that simple. The goal is $500,000 for the drive. We're getting really close. I didn't see the number, but I know we're very, very close here, and we want to try to wrap it up by 7 o'clock this evening. So please call 1-800-456-5372. Please go online to KERA.org. Think about when you first discovered KERA. When you first found public radio, what did it sound like to you? Maybe you came back a few times before you really started listening a lot. You kept finding it and thinking, gosh, what is this? This is really interesting. And then you started listening, and you listen all the time now. What's that worth to you? Decide, and please call 1-800-456-KERA.
I think we have about $53,600 left to raise. Your call can bring that number down. We are counting down. We're hoping to be finished by the end of the day. Our overall goal was to be done before October so that we could bring you a full unadulterated month of coverage before the elections. Be part of this right now by calling 1-800-456-5372, or, of course, it's convenient to go online as well.
That's right. And if we end the drive by 7 p.m. today, there is a challenge on the table. KERA will get an additional $2,800. That's only if we end the drive by 7 p.m., so please don't wait any longer. Please pledge online at KERA.org or make that phone call right now to 800-456-5372. We really appreciate it, and thanks so much for your support.
Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Tony Fiorillo. He's a paleontologist and curator of earth sciences at the Dallas Museum of Nature and Science. If you'd like to visit the Museum of Nature and Science, we have family four-packs available with $60 contributions or above when you call 1-800-456-5372. If you want to talk to Tony, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Of course, he and his work are featured in next Tuesday's NOVA episode. It's called Arctic Dinosaur, and that will be on October 7th on KERA Channel 13. It's got to be great to make this really amazing discovery when there's a film crew following you around. Can you talk about, was it a pachyrhinosaur skull that you found?
The thing that's featured in the film for us is the recovery of a pachyrhinosaurus skull. And pachyrhinosaurus is a horned dinosaur that was a cousin of Triceratops. And it's a pretty good-sized horned dinosaur. Some of them were actually fairly small, but Pachyrhinosaurus was about 20 to 25 feet long. So we're talking about a good-sized animal. And the bone bed, which is what we call this big collection of bones where literally hundreds upon hundreds of bones are preserved, is there seems to be somewhere around 14, 15 of these individuals that we've found so far. And the skull is about the size of a desk. That's the closest thing I can think of to describe its size. It's about the size of your average desk. And really, it's a mix of emotions when you find something like that, especially something that's really cool, really big. And for me, it was the first time I'd ever found the horned dinosaur skull. Is your first thought is, wow, this is so amazing. I mean, you're just filled with elation about, oh. And then your very next thought is, oh, God, how am I going to get this out of here? So it happens very quickly. And in this case, the Pachyrhinosaurus skull, the bone bed, is perched on top of about a 300-foot cliff out in the middle of nowhere. So you can imagine you have this great mix of emotion as to, all right, here it is, now what?
Yeah, you talk about a mix of emotions, and there's this extraordinary scene where you guys have sort of packed this thing up in like plaster of Paris, basically. You put a cast around it?
Plaster with burlap.
And a helicopter comes along, mm-hmm. and you put this thing into like a net bag, it looks like, mm-hmm. and there you are sort of watching it lift off. What does that feel like when you've been so careful with this thing and you know how fragile it is, and then you have to watch it sailing far away from your control?
Well, you take a deep breath, and you've got your fingers and toes crossed, because the skull, for example, that we have in the lab at the museum right now, that if you came to the museum and looked in the window, you'd see that's what we're working on. The preparator there, Ron Takoski, is, I'm sure, tired of hearing me come in, look over his shoulder, and just say, I can't believe this thing is actually here, because the skull is fractured. It's really big, and where it came from, that you really think, all right, you've done your job. You can take it as far as you can. Now, will the helicopter do his job? And then will the truck driver? There's all these steps along the way where something else could go wrong that you have no control over.
How does it go? How does it happen when it gets to its destination via the helicopter? Does it get set down very gently? Is it sort of hanging in midair while people undo the ropes?
Well, the film shows what we call sling loading, and it's a net that's hooked to the bottom of the helicopter through a cable of about 60 to 80 feet in length. And that helicopter is taking the sling load from our quarry to a spot that's along the Colville River. It's an old Navy base, and it's called Umiat. And there's a fairly substantial landing strip there, as you might imagine, if the Navy was involved. And the helicopter gets there, and very gently, it's really amazing to watch. The pilot knows what he's doing, or she knows what she's doing, because we've had many pilots, and they can set the thing down very gently and then lower the helicopter down so the sling is released, and there it is, this beautiful plaster egg laying out on the landing strip. Now, from there, we have some other things to deal with, and okay, what do we do now? We've arranged with people in Umiat to give us pallets, so the jacket's put on the pallet, and then they operate a forklift, and they move it out of the way to where we can load others. Now, how do we get it from this landing strip that's almost in the middle of nowhere to someplace else? we charter a plane, which then the forklift will load the pallets in the back of the plane. They've been flown to Fairbanks, where there's a truck freight company that we've used, and that's how they get to Dallas.
And is it kind of a finder's keeper's thing? You found it, so you got to bring it back to Dallas to be studied here?
Not quite. The bones themselves are actually federal property because we're working on a land management unit. It's called the National Petroleum Reserve, and it's administered by the Bureau of Land Management. So there's a huge permitting process that we go through. So technically, the bones that we collect are federal property, and we're studying them. We hold them, but the property of the U.S. government. Now, I think the question you're really asking is who's got priority in studying the specimens, and well, that is we have first priority because we've gone and collected these things.
So is the government paying for all the research as well?
Not the Bureau of Land Management. Our work these past several years was funded by the National Science Foundation. And we've found over the years, because I've been working up there, I think, 11 or 12 years, we have used a number of funding agencies. The National Park Service, for example, funds us, although not on the North Slope, but elsewhere in Alaska.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is paleontologist Tony Fiorillo. He's curator of earth sciences at the Dallas Museum of Nature and Science. You'll be able to see him featured in the October 7th NOVA. It's called Arctic Dinosaur. It will be on KERA Channel 13 television. Let's speak to Tim in Aledo. Hi, Tim.
Hi there, and hi, Dr. Fiorillo. I'm kind of familiar with your work. I'm a petroleum geologist, and for the last 30 years or so, I've been going to Big Bend. I know you've done work there. And the question I have is about the Javelina Formation, where there's a lot of dinosaurs found. There are carbonate nodules in that formation that I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yes.
And as it turns out, those things are called septarian nodules or soil nodules. But if you actually look at them and do thin sections and study them microscopically, it turns out that they're marine limestones. Are you aware of that?
No, I'm not. This is from the Javelina?
Right. And the funny thing about those limestone nodules is that they have a coating on them that appears to be melted. You know, you've got blobs of material that are on the outside of those things. But anyway, I had a famous scientist, Gerda Keller of Princeton, look at the thin sections of those that I had made, and she confirmed that they were uppermost Maastrichtian, the very latest Cretaceous. And, you know, my opinion is that they are actually ejecta from the impact. Are you interested at all?
Okay, so you're talking about some nodules from the upper part of the Javelina?
It's actually the lower part of the Javelina is where they first show up.
Okay, and if you say, am I interested, would that mean that you'd be interested in bringing them by the museum sometime?
Absolutely.
Well, then I'd, of course, be very interested in taking a look at them and visiting with you further.
All right. What's your understanding of the chronostratigraphy of that, you know, that part from the Aguja to the Javelina?
If we can just pause for a moment, I think we're throwing out some technical terms here.
Thank
that
you.
maybe the rest of the listenership is not familiar with. What we're talking about right now are two rock units in Big Bend National Park. The Aguja is a what we call a formation name. It's a reference to a rock sequence there, and it's slightly older than the rock unit that lies above it called the Javelina Formation. Now, what was referenced was the work that we've done in Big Bend, which was in the Javelina Formation. And the Javelina is one of the last slices, well, it is the last slice of time before the big extinction event when dinosaurs, the big-bodied dinosaurs that we think of as dinosaurs, all go extinct. And what the bones we collected came out of the Javelina, and those belong to an animal called Alamosaurus. Now, the nodules that were just brought up are, I'm actually not familiar with those nodules. I'm familiar with other nodules that don't fit that description. And sometimes these nodules encompass the dinosaur bones that we're getting out of Big Bend. So I have to say that now I need you to repeat the question.
We don't have Tim on the line anymore. Hopefully he'll get in touch with you at the museum and you guys will be able to talk further. I guess he was asking about whether they were ejecta.
Right. That's the thing that I'd like to see at the museum. Since the javelina has been brought up, though, I will say somebody might ask, what is a paleontologist from Dallas doing in Alaska? And the story, the quick answer I've always told people is we've all been through a summer in Dallas, so going to Alaska seemed like a great break from the heat. But in fact, the story really does start in Big Bend. When we were doing this work in the javelina, when you look at these rocks, and Alamosaurus is a long-necked, long-tailed dinosaur. It's the very big Dino the dinosaur from the Flintstones. And it's not a dinosaur found everywhere. And because it's not found everywhere, that's what started the question in my mind is why dinosaurs are distributed the way they are. And not the broad brush dinosaurs, but why specific dinosaurs were distributed the way they were. Why is Alamosaurus only in the south? And what is it up in the north? And lo and behold, we found Pachyrhinosaurus. And now the question is, why is Pachyrhinosaurus a northern dinosaur? So the whole why is a paleontologist from Dallas in Alaska really does start in Texas and just asking the question. And so the project grew and grew in scope.
Do you think ultimately the answer will boil down to some kind of climate data?
I do think that. I think climate was probably the big driver as to why things are the way they are. I mean, climate decides where animals and plants live today. And so I think that that's an underlying cause for why Alamosaurus is in the south and, say, Pachyrhinosaurus is a northern animal. And then you have other dinosaurs like the duck-billed dinosaur that's featured in the film.
Hadrosaur.
The Hadrosaur, that seems to have lived quite comfortably from the North Slope in Alaska all the way down to Mexico.
Like those wood frogs.
Yes, a big range like those wood frogs.
We'll be back in a minute with Tony Fiorillo and continue our discussion, including what the discovery of the Arctic dinosaurs might tell us about the way the dinosaurs died and how they died, or what it might not tell us. We will return in a moment. If you want to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org to support KERA this afternoon and possibly take advantage of our offer of family four packs of tickets to the Museum of Nature and Science in Dallas. You can call 1-800-456-5372. Those are available with a $60 contribution or above. Of course, if you're in a position that you were going to make a $250 contribution, please go ahead and do that and just still accept the $60 membership contribution thank you gift with our compliments. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And hello to you. Thanks for tuning into the show today. What an interesting topic. We're going to have, as Chris said, more of that conversation coming up in just a moment. But right now, we hope that you'll take a few of your precious seconds and give a few of your precious dollars to KERA. Why? Because we're trying to end this membership campaign today by 7 p.m. There's $52,000 left to go. That means that you, the listeners and supporters, those of you who have supported the station, have contributed $448,000 to the station in just the last week and a half or so. But we're still waiting to hear from some of you at 1-800-456-5372. You know who you are. You can go online to kera.org. You know what's right for you. You've already chosen to listen to the station, so why not choose to support it?
The truth is, we know that there are some people who don't really value information, and they assume that, you know, whatever they get for free all over the place is going to be good enough. There are, though, and I think listeners to public radio in particular are really invested in the idea that quality information is a worthwhile thing to own and to pay for. You don't have to pay more than you could afford for it. If you can afford to pay $100 a month for this service, we would love to hear from you. If you can afford to pay $5 a month, we would love to hear from you, and we will greet you both equally. Just give our volunteers a call at 1-800-456-5372. I have to tell you, they are the nicest people. They make you want to call over and over because they're so happy to hear from you when you do make that phone call.
And they're willing to share their coffee with you, Chris.
Apparently, I've been stealing the volunteers' coffee all these years.
Really. I'm teasing you. But I just wanted to tease you a little bit more today. 1-800-456-5372. $52,000 is left to raise in the drive. This has been a huge success, this membership campaign, but it's not over yet. Please don't wait any longer. There's a $2,800 challenge grant on the table. In order to get that challenge grant, in the door here at KERA, we must finish the drive before 7 p.m. this evening. That means between now and 6 hours and 22 minutes from now, we have to raise $52,000. Very doable, but it requires your participation, which is our ultimate goal anyway. You know, we get volunteers to come in, we get food brought in, coffee gets made, and we make all the photocopies of the pledge forms and get all the computers set up and everybody's ready to go. But really, that's all just so that you yourself will call 1-800-456-KERA so that you will click onto KERA.org and support the station.
It's the reason why we do not have commercials, because we come to you directly. You know, Jeff, you might have seen it. We had a very nice email today from a listener who said, in defense of the pledge drive, first of all, we will open any email with that subject line because we're so delighted to see that. But basically, he said he, you know, flipped on an AM radio station and realized how much commercial time in a non-fundraising week, in a regular week, that you would have if you were listening to a commercial station. There's nothing wrong with that model at all. But we've chosen a different one. We've chosen to try to remain entirely independent in terms of our content. We're able to do that because you support us with your dollars at 1-800-456-5372.
Your contributions make up over half of the money that's used to run this radio station. 53% of the dollars used to pay the bills here at KERA come directly from you, the listeners who become members, the active participants in this public radio equation. We have this fantastic product that we're thrilled to bring to you. KERA broadcasts for free to everyone who can tune into or get within the speaker radius of a radio. And that's totally great. We would not sell it to you. We don't have to sell it to you. You've already bought it. We're just asking you to pay for it at 1-800-456-KERA.
Your membership to this station makes you part of the team that makes this program possible, makes every other program possible. We're so proud to be able to bring you guests like Tony Fiorillo. I'm proud that he's based in Dallas, to be honest.
Well, you said your son would finally think your job is cool, too.
Yeah, I told him he might as well be Bono. Like, this week only, I am the coolest mom ever. But yeah, it's really interesting, and it's gratifying for Jeff and for me, who work on the show, and for Brandon and for Jeannie, to have an audience that gets it, that really wants to consume it. The only other step to getting it is that we need your financial support. It's not possible if you just listen. You also need to become a member, and we can sweeten the deal for you with the family four-pack of tickets to go to the Dallas Museum of Nature and Science. So give our volunteers a call now at 1-800-456-5372. Have that credit or debit card ready, and we do thank you for your support.
Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is paleontologist Tony Fiorillo. He's curator of Earth Sciences at the Dallas Museum of Nature and Science. He's featured in the NOVA episode that will premiere October 7th on KERA 13 television. It is called Arctic Dinosaur. If you want to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Bill in Dallas. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Chris. I had a question about the... He was just talking about how the dinosaur types were dispersed, and he was really interested in and how they could be in such locations kind of specific to their species. I guess when you're talking about the many, many tens or hundreds of millions of years that have passed since they died, I would think you would also want to consider how the continental plates have shifted, because what we might consider north now was maybe not north then. And so doesn't that enter into how you, I guess, are going to kind of recompile the chronology of how it all happened?
Actually, I think that's a great question, and it's an assumption that we've made for the whole hour that we've been talking. In fact, Alaska dinosaurs were in Alaska that far north 70 million years ago, and we know this from the ways that we measure continental drift. And so what's intriguing about the North Slope dinosaurs is they're about 70 degrees north latitude right now, but in fact, during the Cretaceous, they were even farther north than they are today. So these are definitely polar dinosaurs as opposed to unwilling people, animals that were stuck on a raft of a continent that drifted north. These animals did, in fact, live in the northern latitudes 70 million years ago.
And thrived for some time in cold and dark conditions?
Everything that we can tell is this was a robust, very healthy community, lots of animals, lots of herds of animals all across the state. Everywhere we've looked for dinosaurs, we found some evidence of it. And, yes, they had to deal with the pronounced seasonality of life up north. Even if it was warmer back then, the world was still round back then as it is today. And one of the consequences of being round is the Earth goes around the sun. You're still dealing with very long periods of light and very long periods of dark. We oftentimes refer to it as 6 months of day and 6 months of night, which isn't actually what happens. But you have really pronounced seasonality in the light.
So, Tony, what does that do to the theory that we've all heard a million times, that this big asteroid hit the Earth and plunged everything into a really cold sort of winter-like period, and that's what killed the dinosaurs?
Well, that's certainly very popular because it's good television and good film.
But not good Nova, apparently.
They touch on that in the film. And I think that you'll see that the paleontologists in the film, myself included, don't actually buy into that. The impact did happen, and it might have been the last straw. But these animals probably were on their way out because of continental drift, changing global climate, and so that they were dwindling in numbers towards that period of time, and maybe the asteroid had something to do with it. But most of us think it's climate driven.
So how can we use paleontology and paleobotany to sort of predict out into the future what might happen to us? We have the Earth as we know it right now. We know that the planet is warming, probably due to human intervention.
Well, what we do is we provide we don't actually have the means of predicting what's coming, 100 or 1,000 or a million years from now. But what we do through the result of our work is we provide the data points that give the people who actually have the climate modeling abilities, that we ground those models in reality. And so that we provide them the data so that they can fine-tune their model, so that if they can correctly track the past, then their predictions for the future may have some merit.
So you mentioned earlier that you did this work in Alaska on a petroleum reserve that is owned by the federal government. How do you feel about bringing in more drilling rigs and more exploration? Would that hurt what you're trying to do? Would it not affect it at all?
Well, it is called the National Petroleum Reserve. So drilling for petroleum, oil and gas, that's what that land was set up for. There are issues, and we don't have enough time to get into all of the environmental concerns that come up. For me, for our work, this interest is generating a lot more work up there for the petroleum companies. So what they're doing is there's a lot more people to draw on to support our work. So in a way, it is helping our work by having the additional the landing strips are getting smoother, the resources, the gas that's available, there's more of that now, gasoline for the boat motors and so on. So it is helping us.
From the perspective of a paleontologist, is there such a thing as a throwaway dinosaur? Would you want to study every single thing that could possibly be unearthed, or are there some that have been well enough studied that they can be sort of left where they are?
Gee, I don't think I've ever thought of it as a throwaway. With respect to the Alaska work, anything we find is fascinating. And part of that is because it genuinely is, but part of it's also because you worked so hard to get there to have the opportunity to find it. So we don't view anything in Alaska so far as a throwaway. Now, why am I in Alaska as opposed to someplace where everybody else has been? Well, some of that is because I like being away. I don't like crowds. And so when we're out there, it's only the six of us or the four of us or the 10 of us, depending on the size of the group every year. And so we're driven to go there because it seems no one's gone there before.
So you have to choose really wisely when you're formulating your team. It has to be people not only who have the scientific background that you need, but people that you can live with, I guess, for a period of weeks.
Yes, it is. And really our successes are that to join the crew – you have to have an interest, but you're sort of handpicked. People that don't feel they can handle a remote camp like that generally don't come forward and say, gee, I want to be a part of that, because they hear stories about grizzly bears. They hear stories about mosquitoes or snow or whatever. That takes them away. So if you have a well-picked crew that can really withstand whatever nature throws at you and can enjoy the excavation of fossils, it's a really a good time.
So, Tony, when you're not out in the field or planning for an expedition, what's your day-to-day job like?
Well, really, the field work is such a small part of it because it takes a while for the lab and our personnel to catch up with the fossil preparation. So there's that that goes on. There's the filling out of the reports. I mentioned there's a huge permitting process. Well, they want accountability for those. What happened while you were out there? So we have to finish off all those reports, and then you have to start the process all over again for the following summer, filling out permit requests. Then there's also the gathering of the data that comes out of the lab, massaging that, see where did that lead and where do we still have to go for the next field season. So that probably 10 months when you're not in the field is really pretty active. And then, of course, there's also the opportunities to talk to the public and tell them what you've learned, so on and so on. But it's really, there's a lot of research that goes on in those 10 months.
And when you get together with other paleontologists, how contentious are the conversations sometimes? I know there are a lot of areas on which really respected people disagree.
Well, generally, yes. I mean, you get two people in a room and they're going to disagree on something. So there's always an element of being able to disagree. It's how do you disagree? Do you yell and scream at somebody or do you do it in a productive manner? And again, to go back to your field crew, when we're out there, we don't all agree on everything that we're finding on a day-to-day basis. So the evening conversations are, well, here's what I found, here's what I think, and then your crewmates try to shoot holes in it. And so that way, when you go to people who may not be your good buddies, your arguments are more robust. Now, there are, unfortunately, examples of rather strong arguments, heated discussions that have gotten less than cordial. But generally, you have conversations, people disagree, and they try to do it in a constructive manner.
We will wrap up briefly with this because I have a similar question myself. Charlotte in Plano writes, my 11-year-old daughter has wanted to be a paleontologist since she was 5. What course of study would you suggest? And given current issues, how practical would this career choice be and where would she have to live?
Well, most paleontologists come through two routes in schooling. And, of course, this starts in college and goes on to graduate school. One is a geology program and one is a biology program. Depends on what your interests are exactly. And, of course, if you're 11, you've got time. How practical is this? Well, you have to be driven by passion to go and do this. But you can't be half-hearted about it. Otherwise, you won't get anywhere because it's a very competitive market. And where you live, well, you live where you can find the appropriate job that is fulfilling what it is, your professional dream. We have here in Dallas a very good program in paleontology. The geology department over at Southern Methodist University is really one of the premier programs here, and it's not necessarily because I'm a part of it. It's because our record of graduate students is outstanding.
Great. Thank you so much, Tony. Tony Fiorillo is the curator of earth sciences at the Dallas Museum of Nature and Science. He's also an adjunct professor at SMU. He's featured in NOVA, Arctic Dinosaur, which premieres October 7th. It really has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I've had fun.
You can sometimes see Tony at work when you go to the Dallas Museum of Nature and Science down in that lab. And you can possibly have a family four-pack of tickets when you join KERA this afternoon with a contribution of $60 or more. We have just 3 of those left. So if you would like to help out KERA and also enjoy a trip to the Museum of Nature and Science on us, we'd love to hear from you now at 1-800-456-5372.
Online at KERA.org. Of course, the family four-packs are yours for a contribution of $60 on a credit card. You have to call the phone room to get that because there's only 3 left. It's a limited number of family four-packs. What a great conversation, Chris.
I had about 1,000 more questions that I wanted to ask.
And, you know, that's then it was good.
Well, I don't know that it's good if it's good for me, but I think if people responded, it's a fascinating topic.
Well, I just think it's always, I always feel good about a show when we could have gone on, even considering that we spent, 35, 36 minutes on that show today. Normally, it's about 48 minutes of talk time, and occasionally we could go even further because we're so used to this luxury, this wealth of time that we have in the public radio format. You're used to it, too. You don't get this kind of interview anywhere else. If, you know, on a commercial talk station, you might hear a guest like Dr. Fiorillo for 7 or 8 minutes. It's probably going to be broken up by a 3 or 4 minute commercial break as well. So when you have 4 minutes with someone, how much do you really learn? If you appreciate the amount of time we put into this kind of conversation, please support it. $50,700 left to raise.
1-800-456-5372 is our number. You can also go to KERA.org online. Lots of ways to pay, lots of ways to say thank you. You know, Jeff, I spent the early part of my career as a broadcast reporter. I also worked in commercial radio. And if I talked to people ahead of an interview, if I said anything, it was, if you can try to be brief in your responses, that would be great. Because I knew that many times I would only have 10, 12 seconds at a time to feature what they were saying. And, you know, I feel like I worked very hard at it and did a good job at it, but I was never able to provide as much information as our guests are able to provide for us here on this show because we do have the luxury of time.
It is the land of milk and honey, as we used to call it, when it comes to having a conversation on the radio. And if you found a sort of a paradise here, an information radio oasis, then please support it, like R.M. Johnson has done from Dallas, John Cyper in Plano. We also heard from John and Pam Hamby in Richardson. Thanks to each of you. Maybe those are the calls that got us this much closer to the goal. Just a little over $50,000 left to raise, and the drive will end. Paul Sampson in Terrell, Texas, thank you so much. Dr. Colleen McClung in Savannah, Texas, they've done their part. How about you? 1-800-456-5372. Online at KERA.org.
We have this challenge from three anonymous members who really want this membership campaign to be concluded today. If we are able to finish our fundraising by 7 p.m. this evening, we will receive for the station an additional $2,800. That is big money around here. We are very thrifty with the money that you send to us. We're aware. The truth is all of us are members, too, so we want our money spent as wisely as you do. We're aware that you send us your money in good faith. Luckily, you can always check up on how it's being spent by tuning into the programming. You know that you listen and love it. But we would ask that you participate. 1-800-456-5372. Contribute, as Jeff says, to the land of milk and honey radio where we have all this time. It might be like low-fat milk and organic honey, but...
Well, the thing is, we know... Local honey, Chris.
Local honey.
The thing is, we know that there are many of you listening. Many hundreds, possibly even... well, it is the 12th day of the membership campaign, so probably many hundreds. No. Thousands of you listen to the show every day. Maybe it's just part of the background. Maybe you actually take a break from your daily activities and actually really listen to the show. Many, many, many of you call and email in and participate in the show. And, you know, Chris, it's crazy that if 416 people would pledge $120, the membership campaign would virtually end at that instant. If 41 people would pledge $1,000, we'd be that much closer. I was saying $120. So math's a little fuzzy.
We should say Jeff has his calculator out right now.
I'm trying here on my phone to do the math. You know, I should have learned from Jeff Ramirez. Don't try to do math live on the radio.
Don't do math on the radio. It's really not good for credibility. 1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number. You will be supporting your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas-Fort Worth, Denton, online at KERA.org. K261, CW 100.1 in Tyler, K202 DR 88.3 in Wichita Falls, and K257 EV 99.3 in Sherman. The family 4-packs of tickets are gone, but we have lots of other ways to say thank you.
We do. The volunteers have a big notebook with all kinds of thank you gifts in front of them. You can also go online to KERA.org. And you can check out the thank you gifts online. If you choose to support the station at the $240 membership level, that's $20 a month when you become a sustaining member. Probably affordable or right for many of you. Actually, and you know what? I just did the math again. if 211 individuals would support the station right now at the $240 annual membership level, the drive would end. And we would go right back to the regular schedule. The next hour would be completely interruption-free. It's going to be a great hour here on the show. And the rest of the afternoon, and you know what? The rest of the year would be without membership fundraising interruptions. So think about that and call 1-800-456-KERA.
Your support means a lot, and it only takes a couple of minutes of your time to set it all up, including a sustaining membership, which is a great way to stay current all the time. Please give us a call at 1-800-456-5372 or check things out yourself online at kera.org. Thanks.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.